with Joe Biden, former vice president, announcing his candidacy, what that was looking like in head-to-head matchups with President Donald Trump in the polls, and just weeks after Joe Biden had announced his presidency is when Rudy Giuliani started to go to work in Ukraine and trying to get Ukraine to announce that it would be investigating Joe Biden. I'm Mitch Jezrich. We're going to take a quick musical break. When we come back, we will have further analysis for you. Stay tuned. Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. I'm Mitch Jezrich in the studios of KPFA. Friends, before we get into the analysis, just quickly, I want to remind you that these type of live broadcasts are made possible solely because of listeners like you who, in your infinite amount of generosity, donate to your public broadcaster. We are dedicated to hearing this constitutional process of impeachment play itself out, but I also am going to need your support in order for us to be able to do these broadcasts. These broadcasts do require resources that were not budgeted in when we began the fiscal year back in October. And so, you know, this is what public broadcasting does. I am now passing around the hat and asking that you make a contribution, that throw in the hat, whatever you can. Just do your part, and hopefully it'll be what's according to your means, and also something that you'll feel good about after you make that contribution. So for people listening to KPFA, KFCF, and also for our listeners in Santa Cruz, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, or go online at kpfa.org. I'll give that number again in just one quick second. For our friends in Los Angeles listening to KPFK, you can help us out by giving us a call at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. Again, this isn't regular fundraising. Not going to hit you over the head about it. Not going to warn about some goal that we may not make. Not going to talk about some challenge that we desperately have to make. That's not our intention here. Many of you have already been generous at the end of the year donating to your public broadcaster. So this is just me saying we do need to raise a little bit of money in order for us to do these broadcasts of this incredibly historical event. So the phone number, again, for KPFA listeners, that includes KFCF listeners in Fresno and our good friends in Santa Cruz, the number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And for our good friends in Los Angeles listening to KPFK, that number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. All right. I did find today's arguments to be substantive and actually to learn a little bit. What I had not seen yet in the impeachment inquiry process is sort of just this timeline about Rudy Giuliani and President Trump trying to get Ukraine, basically forcing Ukraine by withholding military aid. And as we've heard others indicate, both people who have testified in the House impeachment inquiry, and even recently, which we heard in interviews with Lev Parnas, is it wasn't just that the military aid was on the line, but the entire relationship between the United States and Ukraine was on the line. And that is dramatically important. And Lev Parnas had even said more than the military aid. The United States was worried about whether or not Mike Pence, vice president, was going to show up for Volodymyr Zelensky's swearing in and inauguration as the new president of Ukraine. And he said the reason that was important, because again, Ukraine is involved in sort of this semi-civil war in which Russia is supporting a side. And of course, to be very fair, the United States is supporting a side as well. But it was important, and as Ukraine and Russia seem to have been moving closer towards some type of peace settlement, Ukraine still needed to show a sense of strength through the support of knowing that you had the United States on its side. And so losing somebody like Mike Pence, which Donald Trump ordered not to attend the inauguration, would then send this kind of diplomatic, send this appearance to Russia that maybe the United States support in Ukraine is faltering or is not as strong as before. So seeing that timeline, that Sylvia Garcia, Democrat from Texas, who serves on the House Intelligence Committee, to me it was very interesting seeing once Joe Biden entered the presidential election, once he declared his candidacy, once we started to get, even this even began before he declared his candidacy, but sort of the head-to-head matchups with Donald Trump, which at the time was he was beating, they almost all were beating Donald Trump in the head-to-head polls, but Joe Biden was doing it more than the other candidates. That has since shifted. I'm not saying that's the case now. In fact, I think there's even a new poll that had Bernie Sanders at the highest rate of beating Donald Trump. So, you know, these polls differ. But at the time, it was clearly Joe Biden. This is before the debates begin and everything. And just weeks after Joe Biden declares his candidacy is when Rudy Giuliani began to make inroads into Ukraine, his work into Ukraine, and trying to investigate the Bidens, in particular Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, who has served on the board of the gas company Burisma. Hunter Biden, somebody who reportedly doesn't have much experience in the energy sector, somebody who doesn't have much experience in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine specifically. And those are issues. Those are very interesting issues. Sylvia Garcia also tried to debunk the ideas concerning that it was Ukraine who was more behind or as much behind the interference in the 2016 election as is as was Russia. So I thought today's testimony was substantive, interesting. I felt like I learned something today. Like yesterday's testimony, I felt I kind of knew a lot of what people were talking about already yesterday. Of course, I've been following this very closely. But again, just that timeline that Sylvia Garcia set out, I thought was quite interesting. Well, let's see what other people think. Joining us on the telephone is Karen Greenberg. Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, and she is the author of the book Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Karen Greenberg, great pleasure to welcome you back to our broadcast. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Let's begin by just what was your sense of what we saw today so far in 2 hours of oral arguments?
You know, it's interesting. I had a little different takeaway than you did. I think it was incredibly informative in terms of giving the legal background to what was an impeachable offense, what was not an impeachable defense, the difference between a crime and an impeachable offense. I also agree with you that laying out the timeline was very important to when Donald Trump made the phone call, when he made the decisions, how much it was tied to Biden's announcing for the presidency, etc. But I think that I don't want to miss sight of the fact that yesterday's testimony and its ability to lay out in one large narrative structure, the entire story is just so important to even what we're hearing today, because what they're trying to do is to establish the connection between the long narrative arc of this story and the legal framework that they are trying to have the impeachment discussion in terms of abuse of power and in terms of obstruction of Congress. So all I wanted to say was I think yesterday really was important, and not because we learned new facts, but because what a good prosecutor does in his opening statement, as in his summation, is put all the pieces together in a narrative arc. And I think that's what he did. And that's today's was, I think, fit into that story. And so they went together very well, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Karen Greenberg. And of course, we got you on a moment's notice, but we're hearing voices in the background. Do you have a radio on or a TV?
No.
Where you are? I'm just trying to figure out where that it might be on our end.
I don't hear anything other than
good.
You and some. Yeah, no.
Good.
If I see
I
any
will
radios,
persist.
I'll run
away. Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And I will persist through it.
Okay.
I mean, it gets to an interesting question, right? Yesterday, we heard Republican senators, not all of them. There was John Kennedy from Louisiana who said that he had, for the first time, learned some things, and he suspected some of his colleagues have learned some things. And I don't want to dismiss what John Kennedy's saying, because he has been a big supporter of Donald Trump. I don't suspect that he's going to turn on the president, but interesting he said that. However, the vast majority of Republicans, senators who came to speak to the press during these breaks like we're having right now, basically said that they've already heard everything that they are talking about. They don't know why they have to go through this process again. And I guess there's a temptation out there. People probably already are experiencing of what I would call impeachment fatigue. Did we lose you?
You did, but I'm back. I don't know what happened, but go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. did you miss that whole part?
No, I think I got to that there was a temptation. I think that was the last part about
of impeachment fatigue. Yeah, of impeachment fatigue. Of that we've learned a lot of this already.
Right, and we talked about this before in terms of things being boring. I think that goes into the same category of impeachment fatigue. I think that's okay in the sense that there may or may not be impeachment fatigue. There are going to be moments that are more important than other moments. But I think the longer this goes on, the more it repeats things over and over, the better it is for the country as a whole. And while there may be impeachment fatigue among senators and in Washington, I think in a lot of ways the country is beginning to get a sense, and you saw this in some of the interviews yesterday, that there's more here than meets the eye, and that this isn't going away. And so, yes, there may be that, but to think of it only in negative terms may not really be the fact. Right?
Now, eventually, we're going to probably get to a debate that if the senators debate it amongst themselves, we won't get to hear it because it'll be considered deliberations and will be closed to the public.
Though
we may get the debate from the House managers and Trump's defense team concerning witnesses. And we're still, I want to play something that Chuck Schumer, the Democratic Senate Minority Leader, said a little bit earlier today about that. Issue, and it pertains really to this idea that we're not hearing anything else new.
The same Republicans saying they heard nothing new just voted 9 times on Tuesday to hear nothing new. If they want new stuff, there's plenty of it. As the managers made clear, a lot of the documents are sitting there, all compiled, all ready to go, with simply a vote of 4 Republicans to subpoena them. So this argument that they heard nothing new when they vote against new evidence repeatedly rings very, very hollow.
Again, Chuck Schumer from earlier this morning. We are speaking to Karen Greenberg. Karen, it seems like a good point there. Yeah, of course you haven't heard anything new because you're not allowing anything new to be presented.
That's absolutely right. It's sort of like putting your hands over your eyes and saying, I can't see. And I think Schumer made his point very well. And I think, look, Adam Schiff made the point beautifully when he goes, wouldn't you like to know what was in whatever he was talking about at the moment? Because he did it many times. And sort of like getting the audience to say, yeah, it, you know, to ourselves, yeah, we would like to know. And then he's, well, you can't see these documents. I still think the idea that there's nothing new misses the point, that it is not just the details, which would be incredibly useful and helpful and, in fact, perhaps game-changing. The narrative structure that has been put together through this process is a very important one. And it's like in any other trial. This is why this is a trial and does rise to the level of a trial in some ways. And one way is that what happens at a trial is prosecutors and defense attorneys present evidence, each one on their own side. It's up to each one of them to tell the larger story to the jury. And I still think that even with nothing new, the larger arc of the story that's being presented is new. So that's really, you know, Schumer's point is right, but there is something new going on here with or without new evidence.
Again, Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, and she is the author of the book Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Karen Greenberg, it's been reported that the Republicans have offered a deal. We will give you perhaps John Bolton to testify if we get to have Hunter Biden testify, and that is something that Chuck Schumer said he would not agree to. It's interesting because I guess if he were to agree to that, you would also, Democrats don't know actually what John Bolton, former National Security Advisor, is going to say. And then B, we're not even sure if they were to agree to that deal that John Bolton would actually testify, because the president has offered has threatened to use executive privilege with John Bolton based on national security. How does the law work out on that? I've heard it said when we're talking about executive privilege that the Supreme Court has basically said that it is at its highest point, legally speaking, to have that privilege when it comes to issues around national security.
Yeah, I mean, this is more about legal opinion, and the legal community has weighed in on both sides in this regard. I think it would be very hard to keep Bolton from testifying by executive privilege, but you never know. And you also don't know how the Department of Justice will weigh in, just as Barr did using the OLC memo that was written to give absolute immunity to anybody that was called to testify. So he might not testify, but I think he might not testify for other reasons as well, which is that the Republicans themselves will get in the way of this wanting to support the president and the president's initiative. But you know, you saw that Biden also on the campaign trail yesterday was very firm and discussed in some detail the fact that this wasn't going to happen. It's a weird standoff because in a way what you'd like, at least what I'd like, is for the Democrats to say, fine, we'll take the deal. Because Hunter Biden's not going to, they're not going to want to hear his testimony. First of all, it's irrelevant. It's going to become clear how irrelevant it is. And so it's kind of mind-boggling to me why they just don't take the deal and then see what happens. Because then, as a deal, I think Bolton would have to testify and Biden wouldn't have to testify. So I think that's what a lot of people are thinking, a little bit perplexed by it, and thinking maybe it's motivated more by Schumer and Biden really wanting to not be pushed into this because it's something they don't want to put Hunter Biden through. And they think it's, to their point, it's irrelevant in terms of a larger scheme. The Hunter Biden story really isn't attached to this in the way that Trump and his lawyers are saying it is.
I want to ask you about this issue of relevance for a witness to be able to testify. And yesterday I heard Ted Cruz, who wants witnesses, but he wants Hunter Biden's, who he really wants, a Republican from Texas, say that, of course, it's relevant. The charge here against the president is that this was a fraudulent investigation in order to improve his political standing. Well, how else can we determine if this was actually a fraudulent investigation? Donald Trump in the White House is saying that it was a proper investigation, a proper thing to ask Ukraine to look into Hunter Biden and how he got onto the board of this energy company while his father was vice president. So they're saying that it actually is relevant.
Right. But what's not relevant is what he was, why that would be a problem when, you know, his father was not in a position to make hay of it politically, and why that would be a problem that was tied to this. In other words, is Biden's corruption relevant if it existed, which I don't think it does, but would it even be relevant to this story about the president trading national security and national interests for his private interests? I think part of it is apples and oranges, that you're really mixing things that are very different and trying to get away with it. The other thing is, you could probably bring into that line of questioning the questions about why Biden was so opposed to the prosecutor who was putting up with the corruption of Burisma, and that could be very interesting, which is another reason that many think that what's the big deal about the Bidens testifying, both of them.
Yeah.
Again, I think it's too full of holes, and they would come out both on the relevance issue and in what Biden was really concerned about with the prosecutor in Ukraine, that it would serve to the interest of the impeachment inquiry into Trump and would really be a negative in that direction. But I don't think we're going to know. I think this one is not going to happen.
I mean, if we don't have witnesses because Democrats refuse to allow, if they can refuse to allow, and it's not just Democrats, probably we're really talking about also four Republicans that have suggested they may vote for right. witnesses. But if this whole thing doesn't happen because Democrats don't like the idea of having Hunter Biden testify, hence we're not going to hear from Joe Biden, we're not going to hear from Mick Mulvaney, we're not going to hear from Michael Duffy of the Office of Management and Budget, it's a strange look, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. They should. I think they should take the deal. I think it's an unfair deal, but so what? I think that they have probably, and they think they have, right on their side, and it looks like that in terms of the story of corruption and what's really at the focus of this impeachment. But what we need are, as you said, what we need are Mick Mulvaney, what we need are John Bolton, what we need is the whole list of people, which is very long. You know, it's not just a couple of people who will come and testify about what happened. And it is so obvious that what they don't want to do is to bring forth witnesses because the witnesses will say things, not because they compromise national security, but because they compromise the head of state. And head of state and the people in his circle. And that's just not, look, we've seen this before. We've seen the term national security used to be a rubric for not just protecting the national interest, but making sure it doesn't get certain people either embarrassed or in trouble with the law. We've seen this in the war on terror in numerous instances, and we've seen it elsewhere. We know this playbook. And it's important for the country, not just for this trial, to say, no, we have a process. These are the rules of the process, and you can try to obstruct them in any way you want, but ultimately, we're going to get those witnesses, and we need to get them.
I think you bring up a very important point. Now, there are some government watchdog groups have, you know, created these charts showing the amount of times that national security has been invoked in order to keep information from either getting to the public or at least at the very minimum to Congress. And if you look at these charts, there's just this explosion, this exponential growth that really begins at, you know, right around 9/11. But even yes. before then, even in the 90s, still continuing more so. And here we are, kind of leads us to the moment that Donald Trump may not have created concerning this use or overuse of classifying information. He hasn't created this dynamic, but it's led us to a point where now he is in that same vein doing, which I think is pretty remarkable and even pretty dangerous. And for me is like one of those really important things that may not be as talked about as much as it should be during this impeachment trial. And that's doing a blanket refusal to cooperate with Congress at all in this investigation.
Right. Another way of saying it is this was a logical, if a little bit amped up, foreseeable consequence of what emerged from 9/11 afterwards. And again, was built on earlier things, as you say. And you'll notice that in the statements about this trial, you've seen national security claimed on both sides. National security is claimed by the Trump administration and his lawyers as we can't give out these witnesses or these documents because of national security. And on the other side, you have individuals, Adam Schiff and others, saying, look, this is a matter of national security. We need to know this. And so national security is the magic word for whatever it is you want to claim. And I think that's also something that has led to this moment in time that we've been dealing with for the past two decades, as you say, since 9/11.
In this drift of what we consider and what I guess Arthur Schlesinger once called the imperial presidency, which people are now using frequently this term.
Exactly. Let me say one other thing that Arthur Schlesinger said, though. Arthur Schlesinger said that, you know, and his father, that history moves, American history has seemed to move in cycles. And, you know, from being very simplistic about this, from more conservative eras to more liberal eras, and that the cycle was about 30 years, which is just about generationally, you know, and a little more. And the real question here is, where are we in the cycle, or are we done with the idea of cycles in American history? Have we entrenched ourselves so much in a way of thinking about the presidency, and particularly when it comes to its tie to national, or its claim to national security, have we escaped those cycles? So,
what do you think? It's a good question. What's your answer to it?
I don't think the pendulum's swinging back.
Really?
I think that so much, yeah, because we had a Democratic president, a liberal president, who brought in some very much more liberally minded folks into the national security state with the presidency of Obama. And the truth was, it proved almost impossible to change things, either because of how they read the national security, global security landscape, or because it was just too hard to give up the powers that had accrued. But I do not think, as we used to think 10 years ago, that the pendulum is swinging back. And it's another reason I think this impeachment is so important, because it needs to. It's not just about Donald Trump. It's about what's happened to the country, what it's allowed to be claimed in the name of national security. And now we've seen it at the ultimate, where what's claimed in of national security, the president's powers, have now become clearly about personal interest. And you noticed yesterday that, and today, both Schiff and Nadler used national security, and then right after it, national interest, and then pivoted to personal interest. Sort of, it's the relationship of these three things that are at stake.
We're going to have a deeper conversation about that, Karen, and I hope you'll come back for it, because I have more to talk about on that very vein. I mean, that's an important topic, but the trial has resumed. Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. She is the author of the book, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Karen Greenberg, I know we called you on a moment's notice, so we are wildly thankful to you for taking our call.
No, thank you so much.
Okay, we now return to the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump, and this is Representative Adam Schiff, the lead impeachment manager.
They hadn't leapt out at me before. But first, I wanted to address... my colleague shared a number of slides showing the polling strength of Joe Biden vis-a-vis the president as a demonstration of his motive. The fact that he went after these political investigations to undermine someone that he was deeply concerned about. This is an appropriate point for me to make the disclaimer: the House managers take no position in the Democratic primary for president. I don't want to lose a single more vote than necessary. But those polls do show a powerful motive that Donald Trump had, a motive that he didn't have the year before or the year before that, a motive that he didn't have when he allowed the aid to go to Ukraine without complaint or issue in 2017 or 2018. It was only when he had a growing concern with Joe Biden's candidacy that he took a sudden interest in Ukraine and Ukraine funding and the withholding of that aid. But I also want to underscore what the president said in that July 25th call, when my colleague showed you again that transcript from July 25th, where the president says, "I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike." Now, my colleagues have explained what that theory is about that server, that CrowdStrike server. The crazy theory that it was Ukraine that hacked the Democratic server, and that server was whisked away to Ukraine and hidden there so that the investigators, the FBI, couldn't look at this server. Okay, that's what Donald Trump was raising in that conversation with President Zelensky. Now, I bring this up, this point up again, because you may hear from my colleagues, the president's lawyers, as we heard during the testimony in the House that the concern was over Ukrainian interference in the election. And why isn't it possible that both Russia and Ukraine interfered in the election? Now, never mind, that's contrary to all the evidence. But it's important to point out here that we're not talking about generic interference. We're not talking about, as we heard from some of my colleagues in the House, a tweet from a Ukrainian here or an op-ed written by somebody there and equating it with the kind of systematic interference of the Russians. What we're talking about here, what the president is talking about here, is a very specific conspiracy theory going to the server itself, meaning that it was Ukraine that hacked the Democratic server, not the Russians. This theory was brought to you by the Kremlin. Okay? So we're not talking about generic interference. We're talking about the server. We're talking about CrowdStrike. At least that's what Donald Trump wanted to investigate or announced. This completely bogus Kremlin-pushed conspiracy theory. Now, I was also struck by that video you saw of Tom Bossert, the former Homeland Security Advisor for the president, in which he talked about how completely debunked and crazy this conspiracy theory is. And there was that, you know, rather glib line that was, you know, he admitted was glib, but nonetheless made a point, the three or five ways to impeach oneself, and the third way was to hire Rudy Giuliani. Now, it struck me in watching that clip again that it's important to emphasize that Rudy Giuliani is not some Svengali here who has the president under his control. There may be an effort to say, okay, the human hand grenade Rudy Giuliani, it's all his fault. He had the president in his grip. And even though the U.S. intelligence agencies and the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee and everyone else told the president time after time, this is nonsense, the Russians interfered, not the Ukrainians, that he just couldn't shake himself of what he was hearing from Rudy Giuliani. You can say a lot of things about President Trump, but he is not led by the nose by Rudy Giuliani. And if he is willing to listen to his personal lawyer over his own intelligence agencies, his own advisors, then you can imagine what a danger that presents to this country. Now, my colleague also played for you that interview with Director Wray, and again, I was just struck anew by that interview. And in that interview, Director Wray says, "We have no information that indicates that Ukraine interfered with the 2016 presidential election." That is Donald Trump's director of the FBI. "We have no information that indicates Ukraine interfered with the 2016 election." None, as in zero. The reporter then says, "When you see politicians pushing this notion, are you concerned about that in terms of the impact on the American public?" And the director says, "Well, look, there's all kind of people saying all kind of things out there." Well, yes, there are, but this person was the president of the United States. When he says there's all kinds of people out there saying all kinds of things, what he's really saying is the president of the United States. It's one thing if someone off the street says it, but when it's coming from the president of the United States, you can see what a danger it is if it is patently false and it is promulgated by the Russians. And again, the reporter says, and we heard from the president himself, he wanted the CrowdStrike portion of this whole conspiracy investigated. And I'm hearing you saying there's no evidence to support this. And Wray says, "As I said, we at the FBI have no information that would indicate that Ukraine tried to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. None." And so you can imagine the view from the Kremlin of all of this. You can imagine Putin in the Kremlin with his aides when one of his aides comes into the office and says, "Vladimir, you're never going to believe this. The President of the United States is pushing our CrowdStrike theory. I mean, you can almost imagine the incredulity of Vladimir Putin. You're kidding, right? You mean he really believes this? His own people don't believe this. Nobody believes this. And it's not, I mean, it would be bad enough, of course, that the President of the United States believes this Russian propaganda against the advice of all of his advisors, common sense and everything else. But it's worse than that. It's worse than that. On the basis of this Russian propaganda, he withheld $400 million in military aid to a nation Russia was fighting, our ally. I mean, when we ask about, okay, what's the national security implication of what the president did? How much more clear can it be that he's not only pushing Russian propaganda, he's not only misleading Americans about who interfered in the last election, that he's not only doing the Kremlin a favor, but that he's withholding aid from a nation at war. The Russians not only got him to deflect blame from their interference in our democracy, but they got him to withhold military aid. Now, of course, there was this convergence of interest between the Kremlin and the president. The president wasn't pushing Kremlin talking points just to do Vladimir Putin a favor. He was doing it because it helped him. Because it helped him. Because it could get these talking points for him in his reelection campaign. And for that, he would sacrifice our ally and our own security. But nothing struck me more from Representative Garcia's presentation than that quote from Vladimir Putin from November of this past year, so just a couple months ago. Thank God, Putin said, thank God nobody is accusing us anymore of interfering in U.S. elections. Now they're accusing Ukraine. Thank God, Putin says. Well, you got to give Donald Trump credit for this. He has made a religious man out of Vladimir Putin. But I don't think we really want Vladimir Putin, our adversary, to be thanking God for the President of the United States. Because they don't wish us well. They don't wish us well. They are a wounded animal. They are a declining power, but like any wounded animal, they are a dangerous animal. Their worldview is completely antithetical to ours. We do not want them thanking God for our president and what he is pushing out. We don't want them thanking God for withholding money from our ally. Although we can understand why they may. And to me, that's what stuck out from that presentation. Now, we've walked through in the first part of this presentation, the corrupt object of President Trump's scheme, getting Ukraine to announce these two political investigations that would benefit his reelection. And just looking at how baseless and fabricated the allegations behind them were made plain his corrupt motive. But in addition to this overwhelming evidence, there are at least 10 other reasons we know that President Trump directed his scheme with corrupt intent. There are at least 10 other reasons we know that President Trump was interested in his own personal gain and not the national interest in pressing for these investigations. First, the president only wanted these investigations to be announced publicly, not even conducted. Second, the president's only interest in Ukraine was the big stuff that mattered to himself, not issues affecting Ukraine or the United States. Third, the president tasked his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to pursue these investigations on his behalf, not government officials. Fourth, both before and after the July 25th call, the investigations were never part of U.S. official foreign policy. NSC officials to make clear that this was not about foreign policy. And other witnesses confirmed the investigations, in fact, diverged from U.S. official policy. Fifth, the investigations were undertaken outside of normal channels. Sixth, Ukrainian officials understood that the investigations were purely political in nature. Seventh, multiple administration officials reported the president's July 25th call. Eighth, the White House buried the call. Ninth, President Trump confirmed he wanted Ukraine to conduct investigations in his own words. And finally, President Trump did not care about anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. Let's go through these one by one. First, perhaps the simplest way that we all know that President Trump wanted these investigations done solely to help his personal political interests and not the national interest is that he merely wanted a public announcement of the investigations, not an assurance that they would actually be done. If his desire for these investigations was truly to assist Ukraine's anti-corruption efforts, or because he was worried about the larger issues of corruption in Ukraine, someone actually investigating the facts underlying the investigations would have been most important. But he didn't care about the facts or the issues. He just wanted the political benefit of the public announcement of an investigation that he could use to damage his political opponent and boost his own political standing. Ambassador Gordon Sondland, who is at the center of the scheme, made this quite clear in his testimony.
Now, from Mr. Giuliani, by this point, you understood that in order to get that White House meeting that you wanted President Zelensky to have, and that President Zelensky desperately wanted to have, that Ukraine would have to initiate these two investigations. Is that right?
Well, they would have to announce that they were going to do it.
Right, because Giuliani and President Trump didn't actually care if they did them, right?
I never heard Mr. Goldman, anyone say that the investigations had to start or had to be completed. The only thing I heard from Mr. Giuliani or otherwise was that they had to be announced in some form, and that form kept changing.
Announced publicly?
Announced publicly.
The other evidence gathered by the House's investigation confirms Ambassador Sondland's understanding. For example, recently the House received documents from Lev Parnas, an associate of Rudy Giuliani's, now indicted in response to a subpoena. As you know, Parnas was indicted by the Southern District of New York for crimes including election law violations. As part of the documents that Parnas turned over, we obtained handwritten notes that Parnas apparently took sometime in 2019. One of those notes lays out the scheme very clearly and succinctly. Now, it's not every day that you get a document like this, what appears to be a member of the conspiracy writing down the object of the conspiracy. But that's exactly what we see here. The scheme that ultimately was directed by President Trump to coerce Ukraine to announce the investigation of the Bidens. I repeat, to announce the investigations, not investigate, not conduct. The only thing that mattered was the public announcement. As this note says with an asterisk, get Zelensky to announce that the Biden case will be investigated. And in early September, after Mr. Giuliani and Ambassadors Volker and Sondland had tried but failed to get President Zelensky to issue a public statement, President Trump made this clear himself. He explained to Ambassador Bolton that he wanted Zelensky in a public box. That is, President Trump would only be satisfied if Zelensky made a public announcement of the investigations, which he subsequently agreed to do on CNN. Here's Ambassador Taylor's testimony on this.
And so even though President Trump was saying repeatedly that there is no quid pro quo, Ambassador Sondland relayed to you that the facts of the matter were that the White House meeting and the security assistance were conditioned on the announcement of these investigations. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Now, you reference a television interview and a desire for President Trump to put Zelensky in a public box, which you also have in quotes. Was that in your notes?
It was in my notes.
And what did you understand that to mean, to put Zelensky in a public box?
I understood that to mean that President Trump, through Ambassador Sondland, was asking for President Zelensky to very publicly commit to these investigations, that it was not sufficient to do this in private, that this needed to be a very public statement.
The fact that the president only wanted a public announcement and not the investigations to actually be conducted demonstrates that his desire for investigations was simply and solely to boost his reelection efforts. Number two, turning to the second reason, President Trump's agents who helped carry out this scheme confirmed that his desire for Ukraine to announce the investigations was solely for his personal political benefit. As we will explain in more detail in a few minutes, President Trump never expressed any interest in United States anti-corruption policy towards Ukraine, nor did he care about Ukraine's war against Russia. He only expressed interest in one thing, investigating his political opponent. This was unequivocally confirmed by the testimony of David Holmes, the senior official in the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. The day after the July 25th call, Holmes overheard a conversation between President Trump and Ambassador Sondland, who was in Kyiv. The only topic they discussed related to Ukraine was the investigations. Here's his testimony.
Ambassador Sondland placed a call on his mobile phone. I heard him announce himself several times along the lines of Gordon Sondland holding for the president. It appeared that he was being transferred through several layers of switchboards and assistants, and I then noticed Ambassador Sondland's demeanor changed and understood that he had been connected to President Trump. While Ambassador Sondland's phone was not on speakerphone, I could hear the president's voice through the earpiece of the phone. The president's voice was loud and recognizable, and Ambassador Sondland held the phone away from his ear for a period of time, presumably because of the loud volume. I heard Ambassador Sondland greet the president and explain he was calling from Kyiv. I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
After the call, Ambassador Sondland confirmed to Holmes that the investigations were the president's sole interest with Ukraine because, and this is very important, they benefit the president.
After the call ended, Ambassador Sondland remarked that the president was in a bad mood, as Ambassador Sondland stated it was often the case early in the morning. I then took the opportunity to ask Ambassador Sondland for his candid impression of the president's views on Ukraine. In particular, I asked Ambassador Sondland if it was true that the president did not give a expletive about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland agreed that the president did not give an expletive about Ukraine. I asked why not, and Ambassador Sondland stated that the president only cares about big stuff. I noted there was big stuff going on in Ukraine, like a war with Russia. And Ambassador Sondland replied that he meant big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. The conversation then moved on to other topics.
This understanding by Ambassador Sondland is independently confirmed by President Trump's own interaction with Ukraine. During his two telephone calls with President Zelensky, first on April 21st and then on July 25th, President Trump did not refer to any anti-corruption efforts or the war against Russia. He never even uttered the word corruption. Instead, he only spoke about investigating his political opponents. He later confirmed this narrow and singular focus to the press. On October 3rd, when asked about the Ukraine scheme, he said, well, I would think if they were honest about it, they would start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer. Here's that conference.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer.
So we know from witnesses, the president's personal agents, and most importantly, the president himself, the only thing President Trump cared about with Ukraine was his investigations to benefit himself. To see this even more starkly, it's helpful to remember what presidential head of state calls are normally used for. Talk to any former occupant of the Oval Office and they will tell you that the disparity in power between the President of the United States and other heads of state is vast. Since World War II, and consistent with the requirement to faithfully execute their oath of office, U.S. presidents from both political parties have made good use of the disparity in power in their telephone calls with foreign leaders. They've used those calls to secure commitments that bolstered American security and prosperity. Acting as our chief diplomat, President Reagan used his calls to European allies like Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher to rally the world against the Soviet threat, the shining city on the hill standing up to the evil empire. His calls laid the foundation for landmark nonproliferation agreements that averted a nuclear Armageddon. It was during a phone call on Christmas Day, 1991, that President George H.W. Bush learned that Mikhail Gorbachev intended to resign as Soviet premier, marking the end of the Soviet Union. Historians credit his deft diplomacy, including numerous one-on-one phone calls, for bringing about a peaceful end to the Cold War. Following September 11th, President George W. Bush used his calls with heads of state to rally global support for the U.S. campaign to defeat al-Qaeda, to work with our allies to protect and defend U.S. national security and combat terrorism. President Obama used his calls with foreign leaders to contain the fallout from the global economic crisis, assemble an international coalition to fight the Islamic State, and of course to rally support for Ukraine following Russia's invasion of Crimea. No matter what you think of the policy views or priorities of these prior presidents, there is no question that they are examples of the normal diplomacy that happens during presidential telephone calls. And there is no doubt when you're the President of the United States and you call a foreign leader, you are on the clock for the American people. Consistent with the faithful execution of his or her oath of office, a president's first and only objective is to get foreign leaders to do what is in the best interests of the United States. That's not what happened on July 25th. On that date, President Trump used a head of state call with the leader of Ukraine to help himself, to press a foreign leader to investigate the president's political opponent in order to help his reelection campaign. President Trump abused his authority as commander-in-chief and chief diplomat to benefit himself, and he betrayed the interests of the American people when he did so. Let's go to the third reason that we know the president put his interests first. The third reason you know that the investigations were politically motivated is the central role played by President Trump's personal attorney, Mr. Giuliani, who has never had an official role in government, in this government, but instead was at all times representing the president in his personal capacity. There's no dispute about this. For example, Mr. Giuliani made this point clearly in his May 10 letter to the president of Ukraine himself, where he wrote, "Dear President-elect Zelensky, I am private counsel to President Donald J. Trump. Just to be precise, I represent him as a private citizen, not as President of the United States." This is quite common under American law because the duties and privileges of a president and a private citizen are not the same. Separate representation is the usual process. Mr. Giuliani also repeated this publicly. For example, he confirmed this point on May 9th in the New York Times, where he said, well, many things. He said, we're meddling in an election. We're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation, which we have a right to do. There's nothing illegal about it, he said. Somebody could say it's improper, and this isn't foreign policy. He went on to say, referring to the president. He basically knows what I'm doing, sure, as his lawyer. My only client is the president of the United States, he said. He's the one I have an obligation to report to. Tell him what happened. Think about that. The president is using his personal lawyer to ask Ukraine for investigations that aren't, quote, foreign policy, but that will be very, very helpful to the president personally. It's not often you get it so graphically as we do here. Let's go to the fourth reason that these investigations were never part of U.S. policy. It wasn't just that President Trump used his personal lawyer. It's also that what he was asking for was never a part of U.S. policy. Witnesses told us that President Trump's investigations were not in his official prepared talking points or briefing materials. To the contrary, they went against official policy and diverged from our national security interests. All three witnesses, Tim Morrison at the National Security Council, Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman at the Security Council, Jennifer Williams, who listened to the July 25th call, testified that when President Trump demanded that President Zelensky investigate the Bidens, he had completely departed from the talking points that they had prepared for him. Now, before I get to the video clip, I just want to underscore this. He's not obligated to use his talking points. He's not obligated to follow the recommendations of his staff, no matter how sound they may be. But what this makes clear is it wasn't U.S. policy that he was conducting. It was his private personal interest that he was conducting. If it was U.S. policy, it probably would have been in the talking points and briefing materials. But of course, it was not. Let's look at Mr. Morrison's testimony on this point.
Now, Mr. Morrison, were these references to CrowdStrike, the server in 2016 election, and to Vice President Biden and his son, were they included in the president's talking points?
They were not.
And here's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman on this point.
Colonel Vindman, you are the National Security Council's director for Ukraine. Did you participate in preparing the talking points for the president's call?
I did. I prepared them.
So you prepared them. They were then reviewed and edited by multiple senior officers at the NSC and the White House. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Did the talking points for the president contain any discussion of investigations into the 2016 election, the Bidens, or Burisma?
They did not.
Are you aware of any written product from the National Security Council suggesting that investigations into the 2016 election, the Bidens, or Burisma are part of the official policy of the United States?
No, I'm not.
Dr. Hill also elaborated on this point.
My point, Mr. Nunes, is that we at the National Security Council were not told, either by the President directly or through Ambassador Bolton, that we were to be focused on these issues as a matter of U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine. So when you're talking about Ukraine in 2016, I never personally heard the President say anything specific about 2016 in Ukraine. I've seen him saying plenty of things publicly, but I was not given a directive. In fact, I was given a directive on July 10th by Ambassador Bolton very clearly to stay out of domestic politics.
So to be clear, when President Trump asked for these investigations, he was not asking for them based on an official U.S. policy. His top official advisors had not even been told about these investigations. To the contrary, they were told to stay out of U.S. politics. And it gets worse. It was not just that President Trump ignored official U.S. policy and the talking points he was given. It was that what he was doing, withholding support from Ukraine, was actually contrary to and harmful to U.S. policy. There is clear and undisputed bipartisan support for Ukraine. Ukraine is our ally. What's more, they're at war with our adversary. So our goal should be helping President Zelensky's anti-corruption reforms and helping Ukraine fight its adversary, Russia, in any way that we can. President Trump's own national defense strategy stated that the United States and its European allies, quote, will deter Russian adventurism, end quote, a clear reference to Russia's usurpation of Ukrainian territory and sovereignty. Consistent with that strategy, we have currently approximately 68,000 troops stationed in Europe. Roughly 10,000 of those U.S. troops are deployed on NATO's eastern border with Russia.